Brian, welcome to the show.
Adaraj, thanks for having me. It's great to catch up.
Yeah, so we know each other from your previous career, I should say now, in Microsoft as a product manager, and now you've turned into full-time investing. So I thought it would be good to, you know, sort of touch base, talk a little bit about, you know, your transitioning into fund management or, you know, just investing in general, and, you know, talk everything about startups and investing.
Yeah, it's been a long journey. You know, I've written about this and I've talked about it in other podcasts, but growing up poor with a chip on my shoulder, working full-time in college, trying to figure out my path in the world, and having all kinds of traumatic issues as a kid and a teenager, you know, getting to Wall Street, figuring out like, hey, I don't really like this, worked really hard to get here.
What kind of traumatic issues did you have? I didn't know this side of you.
Well, my dad abandoned me when I was a child and my mom died of drugs when I was a teenager. So
to start,
along with a lot of other things that I'm not going to probably delve into on a podcast, but you know, so like, needless to say, I kind of grew up with this chip on my shoulder, wanting to succeed, and worked really hard to get to Wall Street, and quickly became disillusioned. I wasn't having fun. And I looked around the people that were there 20 years, 30 years, longer than I was, cause I just got there. And they didn't seem happy at all. And when I talked to them, they're like, they seem pretty miserable, actually. So I kind of washed out in my mid-20s and I wandered around jobs and careers trying to figure out what I do with my life. And, you know, it wasn't until I started investing in startups, I was like, okay, this is what I would do even if I had $100 million in the bank. And that's exactly the question I asked myself when I washed out of Wall Street. It's like, if I had 10 or 20 million in the bank, what would I really do? And it's a really insidious question to ask yourself in your 20s, because in your 20s and 30s, you're so career oriented. I got to, you know, get that next promotion. I got to get that next thing. And really realize that what you really need to do is figure out like what you would do if you're retired. What would you create for the world? And I think that's even more important now with AI and all the things that are coming about, where it's going to take a lot of that administrative work that people have been climbing the career ladder on for decades, if not over a century now. And yeah, so I found my way into tech. I did marketing demand gen for a few startups. And I realized I'd have to change the product if I was going to actually change the revenue for the company. So I moved to product management, built a bunch of AI-powered MarTech, AdTech, sales tech tools, culminating in leading the AI category at AWS, launching SageMaker Marketplace, and then heading over to Microsoft, where I ran category management, which means I had this rather large team that would scale startups for Microsoft, and realized slowly in scaling hundreds and hundreds of SaaS companies in the Azure marketplace that I was having more fun helping founders. So angel invested for a couple of years, and that turned into Team Ignite, the syndicate, which I'm now full-time on, pooling investor capital, investing out of our Y Combinator fund. We have 125 portfolio companies now. And yeah, it was like staring into the abyss moment a year ago. I got so busy with Team Ignite, I realized I couldn't hold down a job at Microsoft anymore. So I took a huge pay cut and took the measly little management fees that I get from my fund and some of the exits we've gotten, and just off to the races. So never look back. I can't imagine myself doing anything else now, and I love what I do.
Amazing. So, what was the first angel investment and how did that happen?
That's a great question. What was my very first angel investment? I was probably a co-investment with my grad school buddy. It's hard to say which one was first. I'd have to go back and actually look at all my notes. I guess I should remember my first one, but one of the first memorable ones was Spendmo. You know, which we had a syndicate on, and you know, that was Bill.com in Southeast Asia, and it was pretty obvious that this thing was growing super fast, growing 100% month over month, coming out of YC. This is back in 2020, and you know, I put a bunch of my own money in this one, and it, you know, 8 months later, this is the 2020-21 kind of crazy time, raised another round, then another round. So that one's been marked up quite a bit, which is pretty fun. That was a wild ride. But I've gotten lots of other ones along the way now that are, you know, 3, 4, 5, 10x markups. But that was kind of the most memorable one that kind of probably ruined me for anything else.
So you first started writing individual checks and then expanded into an angel syndicate?
Yeah, it was a couple of years of a couple dozen syndicate investments, and then a bunch of venture funds where I sat on investment committees. I helped a grad school friend of mine raise a fund. And, you know, honestly, I tried to get a job in venture for a few months. And then I slowly realized that that wasn't going to be forthcoming, even with an MBA from Berkeley and a bunch of experience. You know, there's not a lot of 40-year-old VP level, partner level positions in venture funds, unless you're like this amazing exited founder or, you're like an exec at some Fortune 500 tech company like Amazon or something like that. And so, and I'm also just impatient, right? So after 2 or 3 months of meeting GPs around the industry and getting introduced, it became clear. I was like, I'm not going to get like the proper job here. I'm probably too late in my career and or I don't have the right experience. So, but I think I'd be good at this because I've done just about every job that you can do, right? Sales, marketing, product, BD, you name it, I've probably done it. The only thing I probably haven't done is a software engineer, but I was pretty close to being a data scientist at one point, training machine learning models in my way around a Jupyter notebook. So I was never like a full stack coder or anything like that, but I've done just about every job. So it makes me a great investor, I think. But yeah, long story short, that's why I started Team Ignite. And our mission was to ignite startups as a team. And now we have thousands and thousands of LPs and we can help startups in any way they can imagine. We have partners, resources, mentors, advisors, investors, to the tune of thousands of people that can help, which is pretty exciting. And it helps us win. It helps us get on cap tables. And that just snowballs over time.
Talk to me a little bit about scaling the Angel Syndicate. You know, I've had some of the biggest syndicates on the podcast. And
yeah, you've had like Saeed on here and who else?
Yeah, I have Saeed Ali from First Check.
Yep.
And they all have sort of like a different path of scaling a syndicate. So I'm curious, like, I know I saw you grow actively because I was, you know, part of your syndicate and because of, you know, you were at Microsoft and we were interacting, but talk to me about like, how did you grow the syndicate? I think this is one of the toughest challenges growing a syndicate.
AngelList. Yeah. And I started on AngelList, which I've recently broken up with because they cross market to my LPs I bring to the platform, which I don't like. And they hypocritically say I can't market to their LPs. and then they take a piece of carry share, which is ridiculous. It was a good place to get started when you're not sure what to do. They kind of turnkey everything for you. All you got to do is bring deals you know, those in some cases they'll co-invest or open up their network to you. But I think if I could do it all over again, I would have just done it off of AngelList. I think a syndicate's a great way to get started. You know, if you're an individual angel, do what I did and a co-invest with some other, you know, syndicate leads for a while. You know, if you read like Jason Calacanis's book Angel, you want to get enough diversification in this early stage. Because it has a high mortality rate. But back to your question on scaling a syndicate, it's just all network, right? I was fortunate to have lived in the Bay and Silicon Valley and went to grad school there. And I was there for more than a decade. So I just knew a lot of people and invited them into the syndicate and then had them invite people into the syndicate. And so it just becomes like a knock-on effect of a network. AngelList certainly helped with that. I remember at some point half of my LPs came from AngelList, right? People just randomly finding my syndicate on AngelList. But to be clear, AngelList, the GP is not AngelList's customer. The customer of AngelList are the angels themselves. The GPs are like kind of a necessary mechanism for creating deal flow for the angels. But it's not as if AngelList lives to serve GPs. And I think that's a problem. If you're a GP with a great network and great deal flow, you probably don't want to go on AngelList. You probably want to run it on Carta or Decile, where I run some of my stuff, or Sidecar. You know, kind of look off AngelList.
Interesting. So you're saying AngelList is actually not serving GPs?
No, we're not the primary customer. The primary customer is the angel investor. That's why it's AngelList. GPs are kind of like a necessary evil.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I'm sure they'd love to get rid of GPs and just have all the deal flow. In fact, they have their own funds that they market to your LPs. So if you're a GP and you bring LPs to the AngelList platform, they will market to those LPs. Mm-hmm. That's not okay. You know, marketing competitive funds. Like I had a Y Combinator fund, I still do. We raise it every year as a public fund. I can talk about it. And they also have a demo day fund that they run. So they directly compete with me as a GP on the platform.
Mm.
And cross market to my LPs. My LPs are like, wait, is your AngelList? I just got an email from AngelList about their demo day fund. Is that your fund? No, that's another fund that competes with ours.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But isn't like AngelList, who started the fund first? Like the YC fund?
Oh, I don't know who had the first YC fund. I think maybe Rebel or Pioneer. Probably had the first YC fund. It certainly wasn't like my idea, but I noticed that, you know, there's a couple moving parts when I was running YC syndicates years ago, and I still do some from time to time. It's harder and harder to syndicate deals nowadays, I think. And but back then, because there's just not as much LP demand as there was back in 21 and 2020, the market's still pretty soft for that, I think. But back in 2021, you know, the best deals wouldn't want to syndicate. So you got, you know, back then it was 400 companies in a batch. And most of them would say, no, round's full, I don't want to syndicate. And this happened enough, or in some cases I'd raise 100, 200K at a $15 million valuation. I'd go back, we're ready to wire, we have the syndicate, you know. And raising a syndicate's hard, it's a lot of work. And they'd be like, no, it's 25 million now. I'm like, well, we had an agreement at 15. I went and raised from, you know, dozens of LPs. And all kinds of shenanigans like this would happen. And I just got tired of it. And that's why I started the YC fund in the first place. So I'd have dry powder and be able to move on the fastest moving deals as quick as possible.
Yeah. I was just talking to someone yesterday who said, you know, they want to do syndicates. And I did syndicates, right? And the problem is, you might as well do a fund. Like it's probably lesser work than
actually. Syndicates actually probably harder than running a fund. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you put the same amount, probably you could raise a committed capital structure rather than doing a syndicate, right? The amount of time it requires to close deals with the
You're better off just raising a small fund and you lose a very small niche.
Also, right? And sometimes because you're promising the founder, if the LPs don't believe in what you are seeing in that company, then it's your reputation on the line.
Right.
Even though like you have no intention to sort of, you know, go back on your word, you're sort of like in this weird scenario where you have to sort of, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're best off figuring out what's your unique value add, your unique network, your niche, and going very, very, very specific on what you're good at, and then doing a syndicate in that area, a fund in that area, rather than trying to do a bunch of syndicated investments.
And you mentioned this slightly just now that, you know, closing a syndicate is now much harder. I mean, it was always harder in a sense, right?
Yeah.
Especially for someone who's doing new. Like, how is it today? Because I stopped doing syndicates for a while, but I see some of your emails here and there. Are you still doing
syndicates? Yeah, we got some out there. I guess it's wishful thinking, but there's still a very high failure rate. I think that even back in 21, like maybe one and two would close.
Yeah.
Maybe two and three, you know, so, you know, more than half, call it. And it got down to where now I'd say we're like one in four, one in five will actually raise enough money to close. And then AngelList has actually increased their fees recently, which has increased their minimum. Which means now to even close a syndicate on AngelList, you got to raise 100K, which doesn't sound like a lot of money. But when everybody's wiring two or 3K checks, maybe 5K checks, there's a lot of people have to commit to get to that minimum bar. And which is why we started running a lot of our deals on Sidecar, because it's a lower fee. It's only 4,500. for 10 years of the syndicate life. It's a master series LLC, just like AngelList, but they use a lot more software. And their customer is the GP, it's me. And then, so what that means is now as a GP, if I can only raise 30K, yeah, I can go like, you know what, I'm going to close this. It's a, you know, $4,500 fees. We raise 30, I'll wire 25K to the founder. It's a smaller check than I would have liked, but at least we can close a deal. And there were so many.
So Sidecar offers a 30K deal, like it will allow you. I know like AngelList used to have like 80K and now you're saying it's 100K.
It's 100K now.
Got it.
Yeah. Because their fees are 10K now.
So
what AngelList tries to do is like you'll raise 70K or 80K and they're like, well, can you make up the other 2 or 3K with your own money? Yeah. And they're like, no. I already have to put up 1% per AngelList rules and 2% if you're raising from Canadian LPs.
Gives me anxiety of closing the deals.
Yeah, and now I don't face that anymore, you know. And I went through this like marketing phase where I was like, you know, and you'll see this with some of the AngelList syndicate leads. They'll like be like, all right, last call, and okay, you got to come in by Friday, and like, oh, we got a crazy announcement. Somebody joined the round, and it's da la 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 la. It's just like turns into this like beating of the drum to try to close syndicates.
Yeah.
And like in the meantime, like I'm trying to take a page out of Jason Calacanis's book, which is he announces the deal and that's it. It's like deal number 297. You know, and like you never hear another email about it. And that's what I've been trying to live by, running my own syndicated investments off of AngelList is I'm not going to like pound my LPs over the head with like last call and it gets to be kind of annoying and LPs will unsubscribe and not take me seriously.
So what's been successful on AngelList these days? Because I have stopped like doing syndicates actively and focused on outside AngelList. So, I mean, what is your experience? Is it like, because what's the main business right now on AngelList? Are the funds the main business?
Well, I'm taking my YC fund off AngelList actually. So it was a rolling fund. Mm-hmm. You know, and it turns out I was running the numbers on this and a rolling fund seems like a really great concept to get started, but if you actually run the numbers on the fees, it's a very, very high fee structure. If you think about like a traditional 10-year fund where you raise for a year, deploy over 3 or 4 years, and then there's like this there's this admin fee of running the fund. Well, if you go with somebody like Sidecar, that fee is about half, or even less than half, maybe 60-70% less to run your equivalent fund. Over there, they have a fund plus product that I've been looking at. Now, I haven't closed the new fund yet on Sidecar, but so far it's been going really well. And so we're looking forward to that.
Nice. So let's talk a little bit about YC, you know, companies and investing in YC. Like, I think you started around investing in 2020, if I'm not wrong. Or earlier than that, and thinking in the middle.
I think my very first YC investment was like 2019, 2020. Yeah.
2019. Yeah. So right about the same time, I think I also invested in YC companies. But there was this sudden bump, right? Like I used to see, I think it's maybe 2021, post money valuations of 60 million on just
launch pre revenue. Three guys from Google. Yeah.
Three guys from anywhere it could be. but it was sort of ridiculous. After a while, I was like, not taking calls from YC.
Yeah, some VCs I really respect won't touch YC. They don't go to demo day. They don't talk to any YC founders near demo day. They're just like, call me in a year. Because if you look at the YC deals objectively, and I'm going to get some sharp elbows for this probably from Gary Tan or somebody. But if you look at the YC deals objectively, it's like, oh, we pivoted 5 weeks ago. We got 4 paid pilots and we're raising at a 20 cap. You're like, well, that sounds like a friends and family round to me. You know, I should be investing at a $3 million, maybe $5 million valuation, but you're raising at a $20 million. Yeah, you're an amazing team. You came from insert your favorite Stanford. Ivy League, Stanford, Harvard, whatever, MIT. But, you know, like I can go to like a Techstars demo day, get an equivalent team that also went to MIT. And probably invest at a 10 cap and they have a way more traction. Like I just invested in a company, you know, 500,000 of revenue, 13 cap, MIT, using AI, you know, to disrupt an industry. That same company would be 25, 30 cap at YC. So it's,
I feel like there are two categories of investors in, you know, in the game that you and I are in. Like, there are investors who are very, very sensitive to valuation, and there are investors who are not so sensitive to valuation and sort of, you know, run towards the fire type of investors. Which type of investor do you think you are?
I'm somewhere in the middle, honestly. I've never let valuation get in the way of making an investment. I've really overpaid for some companies in the past because I was just really in love with the product, the problem, the market, the team, the traction, all that stuff. It just checked all the boxes, and it's a 30 cap. You're like, okay.
What is the push-over? Like when everything is good, but only the valuation like makes me feel that I'll never get a return. Like, what is the pushing factor for you in that sort of deal?
What is the what factor?
Like, what is the pushing factor that's making you say, okay, I'll still do it?
Well, if it checks all the boxes, right? There's 10 or 15,000 pre-seed and seed fundings every year, right? There's something like 150, 200 unicorns over the long-term average created every year. So if you do the math, it's, you know, something like 1 or 2% of companies become unicorns. You just don't know which 1 or 2%. You just honestly don't. Historically, YC has had 10% unicorns or 6% unicorns, depending on the data set you look at and the years. And I think that data is a little strange because it's back when they had batch sizes of 20 or 30, you know, so it's a little different. I think now when you have batch sizes of, you know, 250. But I think back to your question, if it checks all the boxes, it really depends on your strategy as an investor, right? If you're the kind of fund manager that's going to make 15, 20, maybe 30 high conviction bets in your fund, maybe and you're very niche focused, like you only do AI, you only do fintech. So you know that space really, really well. You know all six teams working on this problem and you're a big check so you can throw your weight around. Maybe you can negotiate a better price. Maybe you know of another team that's working on the same problem that you can get in for, you know, half the cost. But I think it might have been Don Valentine, you know, Sequoia. It was like, you don't ever let valuation get in the way of making the right investment. And so if it's the right investment, it's not that valuation doesn't matter because you don't want to invest like 100 cap with like no revenue or something like that. That would be ridiculous. I got a deck where a guy was raising billion. He was raising like, at a 2 billion cap. He was raising like 400 million on 2 billion cap. It was a bunch of BS. Like, there's no way it made sense. But,
yeah.
You know,
I mean, for me, it's still hard to reconcile that fact that never make valuation come in the way, because that's sort of what the logic which led to that 2021, 2022 peak. Everyone was giving the same exact line. That, you know, never let valuation get in the way of a good company, because everyone thinks that's a company they're investing in is a good company.
Yeah, I mean, in part of your strategy, it kind of depends on, you know, there's, you know, every fund and every, you know, money manager, GP, startup is like a snowflake, and it's just always on a case by case. You have to imagine, like, okay, you can invest in one company that's a 30 cap. And you, let's say you target 10% ownership, right? Okay, great. So I got to put $3 million up to get my 10% ownership. Or I could invest in six companies at a 5 cap and get the same amount of ownership. Would you rather have six shots on goal if you're a pre-seed or seed investor, or just one shot on goal? I veer towards, you know, multiple shots on goal. I think if you think about probability theory, portfolio theory, kind of the statistical likelihood of certain outcomes, you kind of want to have more shots on goal. And I think this is, you know, and I've been telling my LPs this, is I think, you know, part of Team Ignite's vision is to be the world's leading pre-seed and seed investor someday, which would require, I'm in the top, you know, 5 or 10% of deals every year, which would mean I would need to invest in 500 or 10 a week, roughly. So that's the vision for Team. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the vision for Team Ignite, is someday we're doing 500 deals per year, 1,500 per fund of the best pre-seed and seed companies out there. And yeah, we're going to get it wrong a lot, but guess what? You know, if we're right even once in that fund, which we have a pretty high probability of doing, if we make 1500 shots on goal, we have a pretty high probability of getting at least one that goes 10,000x or 1,000x and returns, you know, most, if not the entire fund, or even 5 and 10x as the fund. So that's the statistical realities, I think, of early stage investing right now. That's one strategy. That's not the right strategy. I just think that's the strategy I'm going to follow. There's another strategy that says, yeah, I'm going to do seed and lead, and I'm going to have really, really high conviction, and I'm going to write really big checks and into a very small number of companies, and I'm going to like take a board seat, and I'm going to sit with them, and it's a different kind of strategy. They're both a lot of work, and there's no right strategy. Everybody has a different way of getting the cat, or whatever the phrase is.
You're seeing so many pitches, you know, evaluating startups. What are the big red flags in a pitch for you?
Chasing valuations, I think, would be the biggest one. You know, we're gonna have a $1 billion outcome. Google's gonna want to buy us for $10 billion. Mm. You know, we're gonna IPO in 4 years. You know, I think it's clear. You know, what I'm looking for, and I'll actually ask founders this sometimes, is I'm looking for a chip on their shoulder. I have a chip on my shoulder, which I shared at the beginning of the podcast. Mm-hmm. And so I'll usually say, hey, what put that chip on your shoulder? And by the way, for me, it's, you know, what I said earlier, and kind of diffuses the tension a little bit. And you can kind of tell when people have chips on their shoulders, like they have to like succeed. They have to go make a dent in the universe. Steve Jobs had a big chip on his shoulder. Elon Musk has a big chip on his shoulder. And
Josh Wolf from Lux Capital.
Yeah.
Chips on the shoulder.
I should have called it Chip Capital.
Chip Capital.
That's what I should have called Team Ignite, because that's what we're looking for. You know, the vision for Team Ignite was to ignite startups as a team, but really what we're looking for are scrappy entrepreneurs with chips on their shoulder.
How do you recognize that someone has a chip on their shoulder? And
you don't know until you meet them. Yeah. You ask the why in your screening form or whatever. You know, we have one of those screening forms. You know, why are you building this business? But you really actually can't tell until you meet them. And you're kind of looking for a strong force, right? Mm. When you meet with somebody and they're like, I'm like, wow, this person is strong like mule piss, is one of my sales leaders used to say. Pretty funny phrase. Strong like mule piss. But you're looking for like a strong person that's like, they're going to succeed no matter what. Whether or not like I sit on their board, write them a big check in the seed and lead, or I just write them a little $2,500 check for my syndicate, they're going to be successful. And I'm just trying to find those people and ride on their coattails, right? And hopefully help them, right? Introduce them to the right people, help them fundraise, find the right person on Team Ignite to help them hire VP of Eng, whatever it is. But really just looking for people that are going to be successful irregardless of anything I do.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, trends. Like, I mean, you're actively investing pre-seed, you know, what are you seeing in terms of trends? Obviously AI must be high, but I just want to understand what specifically you're seeing even in AI.
Yeah. I mean, I've been around AI since the early 2010s, built a lot of AI stuff, led the AI category for AWS, did a lot of cycle, right? You know, we kind of seem to have like cycled down and then cycled right back up with ChatGPT, obviously. So what I'm seeing now is like kind of, the beginnings of a new platform paradigm of this platform shift, right? You're seeing all the X4 LLMs kind of stuff, right? Oh, it's security. It's verifiability. It's how do you, you know, host these models at scale? How do you create a platform to fine tune these? How do you create orchestration around all these different agents? How do you create workflows? And so, you know, and then, you know, I think you're seeing companies raise at very high valuations. You know, luckily we don't really play in the foundation model layer. I think that's a really tough place to play. I think you're seeing a lot of open source models start to catch up, and sometimes with fine tuning surpass the state of the art closed models. And I think, you know, generally, I've been saying this for years, is AI is eating software. right? And so it's generating more software. Developers are more efficient than they ever been. And I think you're just going to see a proliferation, a thousand SaaS flowers blooming of software everywhere. Mm. I think companies are going to be able to create value faster, get to market faster than ever, respond to customer needs faster than ever, more efficiently, more revenue per employee. So I think it's like the best time to be an early stage investor, call it a pre-series A. Really rough time to be in a growth stage company pre-IPO, because now you're like having to go lay off 30% of your staff, get lean, implement AI, and you also probably raised at sky high valuations 2 or 3 years ago. So I'm very bullish on being a pre-seed and seed investor for that reason. I think it's the best place to get alpha in the market. Yeah. But it's the most work, honestly. It's a lot easier just to kind of look at like a Series C deck. All right, we got $50 million of revenue and here's all our stats. And like, it's a financial exercise.
Yeah.
A little bit of market.
In my career, like I got into like actual tech career after mobile. And by the time like I got into Microsoft, I think SaaS became a category. Like, SaaS was also established. And I think in my career, I mostly saw compounding of the platform of, you know, whether it being cloud or mobile and internet, you know, these are like, if we think of what are big paradigm shifts.
Yeah.
Right. And at first time I feel like, oh, okay, this is what actually feels maybe. For folks who experienced the .com era of things, right? I can feel the energy, which I never felt in my career.
Yeah.
For a particular paradigm shift.
Well, and here's the craziest part. We are living through the fastest, most exponential time in human history.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is we are applying 10x more compute to AI every 6 months, which means 100x more compute every year. And there's exponential progress being made at all layers of the stack. We're talking at the hardware layer, right? At the energy kind of raw materials layer with, you know, with the compiler framework kind of layers and all the way up to the application layer. Definitely the models are getting more efficient and bigger. And then you're starting to string all that together and it's feeding on itself. And so we are, you know, these models, I can't wait for September to see what ChatGPT releases with their next model. It's going to be insane. I just can't wait.
The GPT-5, you mean?
Yeah, and I was listening to, or 4.5, whatever they're going to call it, but I was listening to a podcast with Elon Musk. I think it was at the Abundance Summit. Peter Diamandis, really interesting talk. Of course, he gave it from his plane via Starlink. But he gives it a 50-50 shot that we're in the singularity by 2030. Which means that we're expanding artificial intelligence so rapidly, it's becoming the dominant intelligence on our planet. And you know, if you keep 100xing or even 10xing these models every year, it's just an absolute crazy explosion of intelligence that we're going to have on this planet.
We actually 1000x'd AI compute in the last 8 years with the launch of Blackwell series.
It's been a 1000000x in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
It's been a 1000000x.
Yeah. And I think at the peak of Moore's Law, it was 100x 10 years.
Yeah.
We're already 1000x in 8 years.
Because we've parallelized it. You know, before CPUs were very serialized. It makes a computation per second in a serial way. And now these GPUs, of course, are parallel. They're massively parallel, massive neural architectures. They get massively more complex every year at all the layers of the stack. And so I think you're just seeing this absolute explosion of intelligence that's happening. And, you know, I've been an avid watcher of Kurzweil's predictions since the late 90s when I read Age of Spiritual Machines. I think they came out in 99. I was like, I was absolutely blown away. And then Singularity is Near in 2005, again, blown away. And now his new book drops in June 25th. I pre-ordered the hard copy and the Kindle version. So no matter what, I'll be reading it on day one, but I just can't wait to read that book and see what he says. Because I think he's even revising some of his estimates. And it appears that he was even like more conservative, too conservative in some estimates, which is pretty wild.
Yeah. I mean, where are you seeing, or like, what's your take on, you're not investing in foundational models, because obviously, you know, when you're investing in pre-seed and the amount it takes to create a foundational model capital wise, it doesn't make any sense. Yeah. But where are you seeing, or at least where do you think is the value captured? And I can give a couple of examples. Obviously, I think the app layer in itself in every category can be reimagined, yeah, right?
That's right.
So every, there can be a new editor, there can be a new IDE, there can be new video editor, if you rethink starting from first principles just by using AI.
Yeah.
I think you can sort of reimagine every category of software.
It's like there was like AI, a mobile app for everything. And it it was a new paradigm for interacting with the world. AI is going to create this new paradigm for interacting with everything. Yeah. You know, just the other day I was driving in for an AI panel at Venture Summit in my car. I was sitting on a panel about AI. I'm like, well, you know what? I'm going to have a conversation with ChatGPT about AI. And I sat there for an hour in the car and just had a conversation about AI with an AI. I mean, that's pretty wild.
I have a joke that after a point, my AI will talk to your AI and we don't have to talk to each other. And
well, yeah. And, you know, we're entering a super abundant world where we can't even imagine. You have this confluence of like AI, large language models. You've seen some of the robotic demos. We're going to have super intelligent robots walking around doing all kinds of things for us pretty soon. All that's going to be left is us creating meaning for each other and talking to each other in podcasts about it. I mean, that's about it. So I think the general advice is like, find stuff to do that you really like to do now. So when AI is doing everything, all the drudgery, you can figure out like what you like to create for the world. But back to your question. I'm very bullish on the application layer for that reason. I think there's thousands of application or platform layer unicorns that people have never heard of. Everyone's heard of the big winners like OpenAI, and they're big winners, right? Maybe OpenAI becomes the next $1 trillion company. Of this platform shift. Usually every, 10 years, 5 or 10 years, there's one or two new $1 trillion companies or $100 billion companies created, from the shift, right? It's hard to compete down there. You're lucky if you get in there, but there's lots of these 100x, 1000x opportunities at the application layer. So that's where we like to play.
Got it. I think there's also an interesting opportunity in AI right now because, the way AI products are being released and it's all accessible API, I think there is a lot of long tail of smaller teams executing SaaS ideas and making multi-millions of dollars. I think there's a huge, huge, huge long tail, which can be bootstrapped because of the way of the nature of the product is. Everything is pay-per-use. So if you can find a really good niche, which I think there are many, and we're already seeing a lot of early AI apps in different verticals being monetized. Mm. Right? It's very hard to convert a SaaS offering into a paid product, but it's much more easier and customers are willing to pay because it's giving you so much value if you can pick the right vertical and deliver some value to the customer. So I'm pretty bullish on the long tail. I'm bullish across, but I see a lot of long tail examples. If you're a good full stack developer, I think you're missing out on a life changing opportunity if you're not doing something, developing an AI product. If you're skilled enough to create your own AI product, a SaaS application end to end, I think you should go and just try a couple of products. And I think it's very easy to scale up to $5 million. I mean, beyond that would be, it depends on the category and the function of the market.
Yeah, I've struggled with this as an investor. What's the future of SaaS, right? I mean, because SaaS is really a product of, hey, we have this internet thing and we could deliver software over it and charge you a monthly subscription to keep solving your problem every month. Best business model ever invented. But in the future, is there any SaaS, right? And like, let's call it the 10-year time frame. In 10 years with agentic workflows and artificial intelligence and the stuff getting 10 or 100x better every year and more capable. And, if I'm a business user and I have a problem, right? Like I have you know, I need to, I have a restaurant. Let's just take restaurants. Everybody understands that. I need to market my restaurant, right? I need to develop a menu for it. I need to, you know, make orders for food and keep track of when that food's coming and all that stuff. Well, I need SaaS software to do that, or can I just use various agents and agent orchestration layers to orchestrate basically these systems that do all that for me, right? And then who really accretes the value and charges the SaaS subscription for that? Is it these new vertical AI players that develop AI for restaurants, AI for shipping, logistics, takeout, you know, point of sale? It's an interesting question, right? Or does it, or do we have these general purpose AI agents that can kind of spin up any sort of communication, database, networking layer that's needed on the fly? And there's just general purpose AIs out there that can do all that stuff. And do you really need YC to turn out 250 companies every year to fill all these niches? Or is it just a handful of companies that develop these AIs that can, that are general purpose and can do everything? Mm. It's a real interesting question. I don't know the right answer. I hope there's lots of, you know, thousands of SaaS companies in the 2030s still creating these very verticalized solutions on top of these new platforms. And that's, you know, what's crazy to think is we get a new platform shift every 10 or 15 years or 5 years, depending on who you ask or the period of history you're looking at. So like, we'll probably have some other platform shift in the next 10 years that we don't quite know what that is.
Yeah. But I think the next shift, big shift, is probably the unlock is going to be robotics, as you mentioned.
Yeah. That's the next big one. Yeah.
The big one that's stopping robotics, I think, is we are not collecting enough data. I think we don't have enough data to train robotics. And that's the reason we are actually slower, because I think the pieces are there.
Well, the data needed over time gets less too, right? We get better at learning like a human. I think somebody was saying that like the average 3 or 4 year old has consumed more information than all of the world's large language models, which I thought was
pretty. I think it was
Jan LeCun
who was saying that. But even think about it, right? Like we have, previously it used to be like we are coding robots. So it was really not clear how we can make them intelligent. Now, once, you know, machine learning came, this is how we embed intelligence into it. Now that intelligence requires a lot of data. I say why we are collecting less data, because in a lot of use cases, the data that is required by a robot is different from the data that we are collecting. So for example,
the gap will shrink over time. We'll get better at recursively, you know, digesting knowledge from the environment. No, but
I'm also saying that we are not even trying to capture some of these data.
Mm.
So for example, I'm giving a hypothetical example, right? Like, you know, take a burger flipping robot.
Yeah.
Can we create a better robot just by attaching a camera on all the people who are currently working in McDonald's? I mean, it's a little bit insane idea to, first of all, have cameras on everyone.
Yeah.
Right. But if you have that data, imagine
if it has
how
millions
fast
of hours of
the
people flipping burgers, and then it can.
And all the corner cases covered, right? So it would be instantaneously the best robot for flipping
best
the burger.
Best burger flipper in the history of the universe.
Exactly.
Because we can, as humans, I think what the unlock will be is when we figure out how humans, or we figure out how to replicate this in AI, where you can just watch somebody do something, monkey see, monkey do.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I've watched you flip a few burgers, and I only watched you for 30 seconds, and I got it.
Yeah.
And then also like the recursive learning consciousness loop of like, oh, like if I let the burger sit there too long, it gets dried out and gray.
If we don't need to learn that for burger, we might have learned that for cooking something else. But the
transfer of knowledge. Yeah.
Yeah. The transfer of knowledge is still not fully clear. Maybe that is coming. But I feel like you take another category of, let's say, you know, growing crops, for example, right? Like some insane, you know, example like that. Any example you take, I think we're collecting less data so that for the time for us to get there, even though we have these algorithms that probably all we require right now, we already have.
Right.
But the reason we are not able to get there is the data for some of these niche applications, which are pretty much huge, but no one is, you know, thinking that, hey, we should go and collect data from a burger flipper and McDonald's.
I was thinking about this for all the car companies out there besides Tesla. Like, are they should be installing cameras in all their vehicles and collecting data, their own first party data. Otherwise, they're just behind.
Yep. That's I think that's also a miss from automobile companies right now. But I think we can keep talking, you know, maybe for an hour, but I want to be respectful of your time.
Yeah.
So one final question. Who are your favorite investors, early stage investors?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, definitely Martin, who you work with at Incisive. He's pretty amazing. I definitely, what he invests in carries a lot of weight with me. My favorite early stage investors. You know, it's interesting. I kind of just put my head down and just do my own thing. I tend not to try to follow what other people are doing. I know that's kind of a cop-out answer.
You admire probably like, you know, you admire as a carrier.
Oh, like Hunter Walk from Homebrew, I think, has done really amazing. I mean, Roelof Botha from Sequoia, obviously. You know, Mark Andreessen in his early days, some of his early stuff, of course. But I don't know. I don't put a lot of investors up on a pedestal. You know, I definitely follow a lot of the playbook from Jason Calacanis. And it was interesting over the years, you know, when I got started 5-6 years ago, to read his angel book and be like, wow, he's just so amazing, you know, and then following a syndicate and then becoming, you know, I have 125 portfolio companies now, doing enough, having enough at bats where I'm like, you know what, I wouldn't have invested in that. You know, it's interesting to develop your own, you have to develop your own instincts over time, and you can't follow people. You actually have to, you know, there's an old phrase, it takes 10 million to make a VC. You know, luckily now I've invested just over 10 million at this point in my career. And I really think that's true. I think you have to go out and make a lot of mistakes and take a lot of at-bats to develop your own sort of, your own lens on what makes a good investment. And I'm still learning, right? I probably won't reach my peak for another 5 or 10 years. You know, luckily I'm still young enough, right? Cognitively I'm all there and capable of learning and excited to do it. And, yeah, that's a cop-out answer, but I don't really hold any investors in high esteem. I try to think about like, and I think a little bit of that is like, you know, what was successful in the past won't necessarily be successful in the future. And so you actually have to, all you have is now, and you have to look at like each, you know, we're looking at 5 investments every month, and only investing in 2. So good. You know, we have tons of markups in our portfolio, and we've done really well. It's super cheesy, right? And, you have to get, it's, you know, you just have to take a lot of at bats to learn what it's all about. I hate to be an investor, but that would be a terrible thing. So much to catch up with. And my pace, I'm doing about 1 a week. You know, so I can learn a lot, get a lot of signal that way.
Awesome. Brian, thanks for coming on the show. Look forward to connecting with you more offline.
Thank you so much, Anuraj. Really appreciate it.